Well, hello and welcome to yet another edition of Amadeus and Friends podcast. Today, actually, the friends are actually internal friends rather than external friends. And we have the four partners of the early stage team here for a discussion in two parts, really. Part of it is around what we're finding particularly interesting in the whole deep tech sector. And, you know, at heart, you'll find you don't have to scratch hard to find the geek in any one of us. And secondly, really, it's thinking about how best entrepreneurs and indeed our co-investors should think about Amadeus and how to approach us and what sort of things really excite us. So that's the theme for today. So what I'd like to do to start with, basically, is just ask everybody in turn for a quick introduction, who they are and what the sectors are, before we go dive a little bit deeper. And I'll start with you, Pierre.
All right. Good morning or hi, everyone, depending on what time it is for you. My name is Pierre Sochat. I'm a partner in the early stage team with Amadeus. I've got a background in health and bio, and therefore I tend to spend a lot of my time on the life science side of the portfolios. And we'll talk about it, all things digital health, health tech, synthetic biology, med tech, and the likes are very dear to our agenda. And my heart. And I've was an entrepreneur for about 10 years before joining the firm 11 years ago now.
Fantastic. And Amelia.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you all. And I've had the joy of working at Amadeus for 14 years now. So Pierre and I have known each other for a long time, and we've been managing a number of funds together, which has been great. But before Amadeus, I worked at an investment bank in the UK and also in Sydney in Australia. So that was a great couple of years for me out there. And then I had previously trained as an accountant with Deloitte, and then my original degree is in biology and chemistry. And really, that's what I love doing, is bringing this mix of financial rigor and science background to the early stage investing that we're doing here.
And for the entrepreneurs, there's no escape, really.
Yeah, I cover up all angles. Yeah, every bit of your business plan will be due diligent. But I'm based in Cambridge with Pierre, and you know, we'll talk about that, but it's a really important place for Amadeus. Is when Amadeus was established 26 years ago now, there's always been an office in Cambridge and one in London. And so the community in Cambridge is really important to me.
Fantastic. Manjari.
Great. So fantastic to be here. I'm Manjari Chandran Ramesh, engineer by background, did a PhD in machine learning and driverless cars in Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. Started life in academia, but then quickly moved over. So been doing about commercialization of research and venture investing for the last 13 odd years. Was in another fund, and I joined Amadeus about 2.5 years ago. Very much focus on my educational background, so the sort of AI, deep tech software spaces. But also in the last fund, I worked a lot on quantum, you know, investing in the quantum space, setting out the strategy, the portfolio. And so I look at a lot of quantum deals over here as well at Amadeus. And I'm lucky enough to be a part of the Strategic Advisory Board for the government's National Quantum Technologies Program. So that's a fabulous place to be, to really know what's happening at the cutting edge in quantum and where the government's thoughts are, and challenging them on that.
And you had the sort of, I don't know, joy and experience of going to Google, which sounded amazing.
For my internship, yes. I know. People did ask me that, you know, why are you coming back to grey skies? It's California after all. And I was like, no, who would say no to Oxford? And I've been in Oxford now for 20 years. So I'm hoping to expand Amadeus's presence in the same way that they are in Cambridge and London.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. So I mustn't forget to introduce myself. my background is, I was a software engineer, and I, after doing that for a few years, set up my own business, which I then ran for 12 years as CEO, and then sold that business to a UK software company. And that was a real hypergrowth phase following the acquisition, where we went from about 50 people to 500 and floated on the London Stock Exchange and so on. So that was a really exciting period. And then I hopped over the fence to the investment side, where I joined the venerable institution of 3i, which at the time was the largest VC in Europe. So, but along the way, I'd focused, you know, obviously my, you know, my career has been around enterprise software, but also at 3i there was a particular strong strand of cybersecurity. So following 3i, I've kind of, that's one of my focus areas to this day as well. So that's me. The other thing is that I do at Amadeus is we have a relationship with the UK government through the National Security Strategic Investment Fund, and I sort of head up that with Amelia as well, which has been a really interesting relationship. So that's the team. And now we'll move on to the next stage in the discussion, which is really, I'm going to put each one of you in turn on the spot and say, what do you think's, we're now at the beginning of 2024 and for Amadeus, a new phase of our investment life. What's exciting you, technologically at least, around businesses and technologies for the next couple of years? I'm going to start with you, Amelia.
Okay, thank you. It's definitely still a lot of AI for me.
Yeah.
We've been investing in AI companies since 2013, but this ramp that we've seen, especially with the release of the large language models, you know, over a year ago now, is really driving new products to market. And there we have a big issue, not just in the UK, but worldwide, about, you know, needing to see improving productivity. We need to drive forward for growth. And one of the ways that we can do that is through technology adoption. And so I think AI can deliver a number of solutions. I'm particularly interested in various parts of automation. So warehouse automation is something that I find really interesting.
Yep.
You know, you look at Walmart in the US, who are automating all of their distribution centers. And this sort of move from AI and this crossover with robotics is really, really exciting. And so that's a big focus for me.
Amelia, is that platform AI or is it applied AI or is it specialist AI? What are you?
All of the above. Yeah. We invest in all those different types of approaches, but I really see this as applied AI. So people like bringing products to market which can work alongside humans, really augment what they're doing, and also provide for where there are labor shortages, and I think that will be, you know, important.
Yeah.
Use cases.
Yeah.
So yeah, AI is big for me. I also make our investments into novel materials.
Yeah.
Which we do, you know, one or two of in each fund. And this is really important in terms of the climate tech side of our investing. You know, how do we get to the point of trying to reduce CO2
yeah.
emissions? What are the replacements for oil-based plastics? And so, you know, novel materials remains an interesting yeah. area for me.
Well, I guess there's a bit of a combo there in that you're seeing AI being used to invent novel materials or novel molecules that can become novel materials.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And I guess novel molecules is a very neat hop to you, Pierre, in terms of that.
Happy to take this one. Yeah.
What are you looking at?
And I think there's a lot in in what Amelia just mentioned that echoes some of the theses we track when it comes to life science. Of course, you know, all things AI are super exciting. Mm-hmm. But I think what's very exciting for us is the degree of adoption.
Yeah.
Of AI in life science. It used to be, you know, deep in the labs until, frankly, a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What people don't realize is the volume of AI, based or embedded solution that the FDA themselves or itself has already
yeah.
approved. I think it's close to 700 or 800 therapies and diagnostic tests, you name it. There's a number of applications out there. And so it's far from being fringe. It's today, you know, the bulk of the applications going to regulators have a thick layer of AI. So I think that box is really ticked. But
yeah.
what's super exciting is how fast essentially the delivery layer of care is now taking it on board. So we're seeing it through, you know, hospital setups, for instance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're looking at medicines that essentially, and that's, you know, linking with SynBio as well, that have been fundamentally
synthetic bio,
yeah. fundamentally very often designed using AI mm-hmm. and then engineered, physically engineered in labs or in pharma.
What are the time frames for these sort of businesses? I'm getting a bit scary about the time frames.
they can be long. But some of them are also shortening because you can get from proof of concept to commercial grade much faster. But it is an industry where, you know, move fast and break things just doesn't apply, obviously. So you need to take time. And therefore for us, and I'm sure we'll discuss it later, there is a time when it's too early for life science, for instance, for an early stage investment. You know, our window of investment is the decade. And so you it's for some sectors, we will come very, very early stage. For others, you want to have at least regulatory approval in sight because you still need to wrap a commercial proposition around it. But over and above, you know, AI adoption, essentially logistics and delivery is super exciting.
What about this whole health 3.0 thing? What does that mean to you, and what are you looking for?
Okay, so I'll have to to define it first. I think it's, you know, there is a fast moving degree of personalization that's now really happening on the ground. So we've all dreamed of having truly personalized, you know, treatment since the first genome was sequenced, and you go back 25 years or so. The reality is that until recently, very little happened. Today, we can actually design, you know, the end product, such as the molecule for a specific patient. So we've got investment, for instance, in Ori Biotech, which is at the manufacturing end of that journey. Essentially producing treatments that are patient specific and that for a long time was possible in the labs but not scalable commercially. They are making it, you know, at commercial, or will soon make it at commercial grade. But it also means that you can go beyond just the end product. You can personalize the entire journey of a patient. We've got another business called Lumeon who does that, and I was, you know, been doing that for some time now. They work with some of the largest brands in the US, essentially optimizing the care journey of the patient, reorchestrating the care pathways to maximize, you know, clinical outcome and financial outcome as well for the providers. So as much as we love the tech, you know, building scalable high margin businesses is very, very important. Mm. And this is just one of the many.
I find this sort of crossover between the life sciences with the novel materials really interesting, because I think biosensors are really exciting and allows us to get closer to this personalized medicine. So if you have very simple, quick tests that people can take, which can give immediate indicators of what's happening with, you know, how is someone reacting to a particular therapy, what stage of a disease are they at, and therefore we change the treatment. If you can get that information back very quickly from very accurate biosensors, I think this is super exciting, and this is all on then the materials development,
absolutely,
which is really interesting.
I think that with that biosensors as well, what then really matters is which data to send, and being, you know, sort of very intelligent at the sensor level to decide what data is most important can you actually process right at the edge. So I think that's a great area as well within this whole, you know, sort of AI. And I know, you know, sort of large language models, they've just taken the world by storm. Mm-hmm. And the other side, which is, you know, sort of can we actually create some of these intelligent beings without as much compute power, without as much data? That's going to be really huge in the years to come.
So you're switching to the sort of, we've got the first wave of large language models has happened, and everyone is actually then starting to look at the bill in terms of the processing. Well, it was very clever. You know, it wrote this fantastic poem for me, but boy, it cost a lot in compute or whatever it is. So you're interested in the infrastructure technologies that make it cheaper from a compute point of view. Is that right?
Absolutely. So, you know, both from a hardware solution, but also from a software solution.
Right.
Can we actually get this to the edge and make it work right at the edge?
Just before, we're going to come to you in a moment.
I want
to ask you, actually, Pierre, is the whole personalized medicine and biosensors. Mm. Now, obviously, a lot of us wear smart watches and what have you, but there's also the Zoe project of collecting data and guiding you on what you should eat. Do you see that as an area for our investment for, you know, looking forward? Sort of the health tech at the eating end of it.
It's to some extent in the future. I'm sure we would consider the area. I think at this point, it's probably too far down the consumer to be a real good fit, you know, from a business model for us.
Yeah.
But leaving that aside as a solution, I think it's fantastic for people to really understand themselves better. I think it's a great. I mean, I do remember meeting the founders long before Zoe, when the idea was, or the discussion was, about extracting value from this fantastic database of twins that they have. They ended up, you know, repackaging something, some part of it, into what has eventually become Zoe, which is to B2C again for us.
Yeah.
But I think the learnings are very, very interesting.
There's some lovely data there to get
your hands on. There's some unbelievable data. I think the key for, you know, it's a business model question in a way. The key for many of these solutions is the stickiness.
Yeah.
You get very quickly to a point, and some of you may have had it with, you know, Fitbits or other wearables, where essentially you understand your body quite well and you instinctively know what's, you know, a type of exercise, sleeping pattern, foods that you intake will have on your levels, basically. Yeah. And, you know, my gut feel is that within a few months, people tend to let go of the devices. And because the Zoe proposition, for instance, you know, is built on what is today still an expensive piece of hardware, true Abbott. So that's the Freestyle. Just that alone, it's £100 or somewhere there per month. You know, it needs to continuously deliver the goods to the user, and it's valuable. I mean, it's valid for, you know, every commercial proposition. You know, at the molecular or at the biomarker level, absolutely love what you're doing.
Yeah.
Is the commercialization or scalability that's going to be important here.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. And Manjari, what areas of focus? I know that you've been doing a lot in quantum. Is that going to feature in your life? And what else is going to feature in your professional life over the next year or two?
Absolutely. So I'm super excited. I mean, I continue to be excited about quantum as well as AI. I think, you know, sort of perhaps not immediately this year, but further along the line, the whole merging of between quantum and AI is going to really, you know, sort of take the world by storm, because you're literally harnessing the powers of two such good technologies. But in the next year itself, I think, you know, there's expected to be a huge amount of progress within quantum algorithms. I think in the computing stack, we're going to see a lot of algorithms and applications come as the hardware progresses.
Yeah.
You know, we've spoken a lot about this in the last 7 years. It's still pretty much simulation, but this is the year we're expecting some big moves in the hardware. I hope.
Sorry, you heard it here first. Sorry, is this Manjari predicting a commercial use case for a quantum
computer? Not quite a commercial application. I wouldn't go so far. but no, definitely. I think there's going to be some really significant progresses in the hardware side of things, you know. And
you do have some inside information, because we are invested in a quantum computing hardware company. So.
And a quantum networking company as well, and indeed an operating system. So we've got the stack. It's really the algorithm.
We just need more of the top. Oh, that's right, because we've got Photonic creating the qubit. It's got River Lane that's doing error correction, New Quantum doing the scale up. And also, you know, because of our sale of CryptoSense to Sandbox, we have this interest in the algorithm layer at the top.
Exactly. So it's all things put together.
More sport to be had there then. And anything else? Anything else that's catching your eye?
I also like the idea of, you know, sort of going back a bit to basics, and that, you know, yes, AI has been sort of super pervasive in a lot of places, and, you know, perhaps fintech is the place where it's really, you know, taken that area. But there are certain industries, and we saw that, you know, last year with Tenzo's investment into the restaurant space.
Yeah.
There are certain industries that still stick to their Excels, and, you know, they may have all of this data.
Absolutely.
But they just don't have a way of harnessing it. And I would hope that, you know, if we brought in a platform technology that was either, you know, sort of doing it at the edge and hence was able to be applicable, or in a slightly more risk-averse manner, because a lot of these industries, there's a reason why they don't want to engage with AI models. So that's another area that I think is going to be very interesting.
I think that's right. And I think your interest in sort of industrial automation is right. You know, there's a lot of data there, but these are older industries that have not necessarily adopted AI and technology. And I think now that they can understand the benefits that they can get, and it's, it's not as difficult as maybe they thought to adopt, and you get more data science people who understand what they can do with the data, I think that's quite an exciting investment area.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to add one last one, but not one for our investment, I suspect. And that's because I don't think it's going to be easy to commercialize. And that's, you know, sort of how do we get the explainability and bias out of the data that trains this AI?
Yes, indeed. It's a critical need. And I know we have another company that can do that from one perspective. But I think it's always interesting, actually, with these sort of things as to, you can see a really interesting capability, but is it a business or is it a piece of functionality that you stick on something else?
Yes.
So, you know, from time to time, we hit that conundrum. Actually, for my own part, I guess I talked about cybersecurity, and I think there's, you know, I think the number of attacks was yet another record year last year, and the number of real, not just notional attacks and people noticing things, but, you know, ransomware, you know, businesses put out of, you know, out of operation for periods, and even nation states, you know, Costa Rica were hit incredibly hard, and the Dominican Republic narrowly escaped being effectively being taken down. So I think that's a really important area. Obviously, AI has been used in cybersecurity for some time. So I don't know whether it's that, because you don't know. My test for cybersecurity things that come through the door is partly how would this look at one of the main conferences like RSA in the States, because you know, there are so many companies saying the same sorts of things. Even if your thing is a bit better, how will you stand out? So I think ransomware remains a real challenge. So I think we've got a, one or two companies who are focusing on that. I think also the post-quantum cryptography thing, whilst a number of the pieces of the jigsaw are there, there's still a little bit of way to go to actually before we've got a sort of a deliverable suite of solutions to solve that problem. So I think that's of interest. I'm trying to think what else there's.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? If you look back over the last 10 years of our investing into cybersecurity, how much more important it has become. And a lot of it driven in the last few years by changes in the global environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of government interest now in sort of pulling our portfolio companies through so that technology can be adopted earlier. And I think that it makes it a really exciting space. And it's, you know, it's great that we've been at the forefront of that. And making, you know, early investments in companies like Ravelin and others, and
no,
now
absolutely.
I just think it will ramp up quite a lot.
No, that's right. I think the geopolitical climate has changed, sadly, in that there are a lot more issues and threats and a lot more focus. And you know, firstly, I think I mentioned NSIF before. That's helping early stage companies engage with national security customers. And also we're tracking very closely the NATO Innovation Fund, which hopefully is doing the same sort of thing more broadly across the NATO countries. And there are a number of other initiatives of that sort. So I think that's one area. And I think also, I think I'll pick up your thing. I think I'm very interested in the picks and shovels to sell to the gold miners in the AI world. I think there's going to be, you know, there's wave one, you know, you get something out there that works and is cool. Wave two is doing it much better and industrial scale and that sort of thing. So I think that's interesting. So we'll continue to look. But I think we're all sounding, we're trying to sound very clever here. One comment I'd make, though, is, you know, whilst we have themes, at the end of the day, you know, we don't create businesses. We just try and spot really really, really hot new things when they pop through the door. So I think it's the entrepreneurs out there that are the real geniuses who spot the problems. And hopefully we're tuned, our minds are tuned such that we say, hey, yes, this is really cool. If it wasn't one of the things,
exactly.
And quite often it's not one of the things you'll have heard us talk about. So I think for those listening, don't worry if your thing, we haven't mentioned your thing, it can still be something really exciting. I'll change tack slightly. You know, part of the point of doing this is to help entrepreneurs and indeed our investment partners around the world understand what we're up to and how to engage with us. And so First of all, I'm going to ask you, Amelia, just at random. What sort of stage of business, first of all? You know, what, you know, is anything, can a business be too early for us or can it be too late?
Yeah, so I think our sweet spot is seed stage investing up to early Series A. And we've generally thought about early Series A as the way we've defined it is when you have up to about $1 million, you know, dollars or pounds of ARR or revenue. And probably once you get beyond that, it's getting a bit late stage.
Oh, why is that? Why is it then late for us? They're still great businesses.
I think our... where we add a lot of value is at that seed stage. So we're often working with companies who have great tech, but they haven't quite got a product yet. And this is where we're really, I think, adding value and helping the companies get ready for a proper Series A round. You know, a number of the companies that we invest in have a lot of IP or know-how behind what we're doing. And we have a number of technical founders who come to us. And it's helping them really sort of change their mindset. Especially if they come from academia, to leave the academic thinking behind and really enter a commercial world quite quickly and think about product and customer and how you're going to get to market. And really, like, especially on that customer side, what does the customer want?
Pierre, how, of your companies you've invested in over the last few years, how many had got revenue? What percentage do you think?
So for me, it's a slightly different ratio because of the nature of the space or life science. That, you know, there'll be areas where essentially revenues are almost immaterial. It's down to you know, essentially technical milestones or clinical milestones. But probably half would be revenue driven, and half would be really, you know, KPI, your non commercial. A KPI driven, and therefore, you know, my definition of entry point, you know, can vary a little bit. And for some areas, you may want to come in slightly later, sometime in what the company would call, you know, frankly, a Series B. But it's got the economic metrics of, you know, a Series A we would see, or even a seed round sometime we would see in other areas. So if it fits the timelines we work against as a fund, the check size we're willing to deploy, and frankly, the ownership target, that's always important for us. Then in a way,
so
the label
the ownership
is,
target, is it, what is, do you, what, you know, what do you look for on the way in?
On the way in, for life science, you know, ideally 15% is the sweet spot, somewhere between 10 and 20. It will vary depending on the, you know, on the deal itself, on the quality of the syndicate. You know, we always make space for high quality co-investors. It's a long journey, so it's foolish to try to own, you know, as much of the baby as you can initially, because you're just going to end up on your own. So building quality syndicate is key, and that of course has direct implication on ownership. But if you look at, you know, without naming them, the companies that tend to be more on the digital or the software side of the life science portfolios will raise, you know, somewhat larger rounds, and can be much more capital efficient than the hardware one, who will also take, you know, longer to get to certain milestones.
So we do like to syndicate.
We do like.
I remember a deal that I did, and in the investment committee, Pierre said, Nick, you haven't got a co-investor in this one, have you? And I said, no, it'll be fine. And those words came back to haunt me.
I think that's really important. It's very key, isn't it? You know, you get the diversity of thought around the board.
And diversity of pockets.
And funding to help the company at the next round. So, high quality co-investors, I think, is really good.
Yes.
And the network for commercial, investors. Yeah.
So I think that's an important part of this, is that both the stage and, you know, where we're at in the revenue journey is these are small, fragile businesses. You know, sometimes I think, we have
people or one person.
Exactly.
That's right. We have invested, you know, man and a plan, literally, occasionally. Yes. More usually it's, you know, there's a small team, half a dozen or so. I think it's important to create the sense of that fragile, enthusiastic, brilliant team that we want to help. And how do you see the help panning out, Manjari, in terms of these fragile small teams with a brilliant idea and hopefully a brilliant technology and product.
I think it's, you know, as you said, it's super fragile, and relationships matter a lot. So I think, you know, initially it's very much trying to work as a team with the founders. You know, that's, I think, something I can speak for all four of us. We get super excited, and I see that, you know, in internally as well, that we just get really excited about building value where, you know, 1 year ago there was no value. There was the art of the possible, but really there wasn't any. And it comes in different forms. You know, there's our network where, you know, if a CTO wants to really check his technology or product roadmap, we have experienced CTOs who are willing to, you know, help them. We've got, you know, a huge industry network that's willing to not just mentor, but make the right introductions at the right time, at the right levels, because, you know, you know this, the entire sales is not about just speaking to the CEO of the customer or indeed the end user of the customer. It's a multiple level conversation. And so I think, you know, the fact that Amadeus has a 26-year history means that that network is so useful.
No, absolutely. I was, there's a company we're, a company we're invested in, which is a computer vision company that's also starting to work on audio because it's redacting video and now audio because body-worn cameras. And it was a wonderful session we had with Professor Steve Young from Cambridge, who's one of our venture partners now. That's a fantastic result. And it was, you know, he is the man when it comes to speech and, you know, AI applied to speech. And he's been behind, I know, and some of your businesses in the past. That was, as a spectator on the conversation between Steve Young and the CTO of Pimlock, it was a fabulous thing to watch, to see the value that can be added. And I think that's, I think what's really interesting is how, you know, we talk about the areas we're interested in, and, you know, if I pin Amelia to the wall and say, get me somebody who's a materials specialist in this domain, I know that she'll come up with somebody who will be incredibly, you know, world-class expert. And, you know, these people, the nice thing is these people are often, you know, a little bit like us, you know, geeks and obsessive about the technology, and they'll help often for nothing. And that, you know, a couple of 1 hour Zoom calls or whatever can make a huge difference to these companies. So I think what other, you know, we've talked about what other things can we bring to bear, you know, to, we've talked about if the way in, you know, for these fragile, wonderful little companies with brilliant technology, you know, we hopefully help them grow to the next stage. And in terms of, you know, the big Series A, and I know that this is, you know, for the fund that we have been investing, we've had a lot of companies going through the big Series A. We've had three companies raise over $100 million, which is fantastic. How does that work? What's that dynamic feel like? Who wants to take this one?
I'm happy to give you at least my, you know, my view. I think a lot of, in a way, it's, you know, this point and back to the previous one, what do we add? How do we create, you know, the value? How do we get to that Series A? You need some of the usually, you know, ingredients. You need the market, you need the team, you need the tech, the defensibility, etc. The one that I always look for, on top of all that, and I think what we can create, to Manjoy's point, is momentum.
Yeah.
And this is really key. And usually what gets you to that, you know, chunky Series A, and chunky is subjective, depending on the industry, you know, you either remove zeros, is how quickly you go from A to B, essentially, or from C to A in this case. But it's how fast you can scale a proposition, validate it, go to your first, you know, pilot project, to a scale up, to another pilot, bring in talent. And it's really creating the tension in the market, creating the tension amongst the investor community. And of course, delivering, you know, continuously on the technical KPIs or clinical KPIs, that's key. But creating momentum is, you know, what I see as the most exciting and valuable you know, factor. And that's something that we can do through intros and you know, we've been there, done it. Creating momentum also means don't take, you know, avoiding pitfalls and wrong turns.
Yeah.
You know, that's also part of it.
And in terms
having
of,
been there,
helps. In terms of finding those investors who can write 10, 20, 30 million checks, Amelia, Where do you go knocking?
Yeah, I think it's been interesting over the last 18 months of this sort of correction in the pricing in funding rounds, but also more importantly, the way that these later stage investors are really looking to see growth, whether that's revenue growth or proxies for growth. So, you know, what are your numbers of users or have you hit your various milestones? And also how operationally efficient are you doing that? Which I think is driving good focus in our portfolio companies. So it's like, what's our key proposition? Let's focus on that and let's really show development so that we can go out to these Series A investors and show that things have moved on. And also, how do we do it in a very capital efficient, efficient way? And so have we got an idea of what the longer term, you know, gross margins, et cetera, will look like? And I think if we can help our companies sort of formulate that package so that then we can go to the Series A investors and say, hey, we've got this amazing team with this great product that's going to be selling into this massive market. So we can create a really large global opportunity here. But also they have traction and they have this momentum that Pierre is talking about. So we can point to early revenue growth. We can point to numbers of users.
And where are these investors?
So that's worldwide.
Yeah.
So, which I think is really exciting. Yeah. If we look at the map of where our co-investors are, you know, it goes from the West Coast in the US, you know, to Japan, Singapore, into Europe. And so depending on the business, you know, we look for where the investors will be interested in that particular company. And I think, you know, we have strong co-investment relationships because of our existing portfolio. And so we really work hard to build on those.
Yeah, it certainly helps when you're sitting on a board with somebody.
Yeah.
You say, and who maybe came in to your current company to say, hey, I've got a fabulous new company for you to look at. And that's these relationships. I'm going to change tack now. So for the final part of this really is focused on the entrepreneurs. How is it best to approach us? And I'll give a clue from my own point of view is that every now and again I'll get health tech deals sent to me, which, as you'll have heard from the expose here, that's a miss in my mind. So, you know, Manjari, how best should an entrepreneur in a space that they should have done their research and figured out which one of us is hot on what? And there's a bit of overlap, but that's fine. How best to approach you?
Email or LinkedIn. I think those are the two nowadays that are best. And of course, you know, sort of we all go to conferences. So that's a great way for us to sit with, you know, sort of star players in the entrepreneur community and just understand whether at a high level this is likely to fit or not. I also think, you know, sort of going back to our what do we look for, you know, market opportunity is such a crucial part of all of this. The three things that we can't change when we see an investment is the market opportunity that the technical differentiation can actually change. The star quality of the founders, you know, how star talent attracts other star talent. That's something we just can't change, however much we try. And of course, the technical differentiation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if there is really big market opportunity, just work out which one of the four of us is excited and email us.
Fantastic. And anything to add to that?
I think the events are important and we work hard to try and get all our events listed on our website so that people can see where we're going to be so that we're out and about. But certainly, you know, LinkedIn and other means like that, it's a way of getting to us.
Yeah. And Pierre, also, I guess you get things coming through our network as well, of course, rather than just...
Yeah, I was about to say you need to do the work. Essentially, it's not dissimilar to trying to get to the right contact point within a target client organization. You need to understand how the org chart is structured. Essentially, there who to talk to, where the budget lies, and frankly, is the same when you talk to financiers, which is who we are at the end of the day. Maybe to give the audience a sense of scale, and we see what 1,000 to 2,000 proposition a year, and we'd invest in 5-6 new companies.
Yeah.
And I think that says a lot as to, it takes It takes us a lot of work, frankly, to go through that, to meet the team, and anything you can do to help us notice you faster than the rest is in your favor, essentially. I think the number one parameter for me is essentially a warm referral from someone I know and trust. And you know, this is essentially fast tracking it, and it will put you in, you know, in a mental shortlist. Then we still need to obviously be convinced by the proposition. But the cold emails, I think historically we've done one or two deals out of 200 plus that came cold. The rest is always true, essentially networks.
But I think I think the key message, just to sort of, you know, I think we're getting towards the wrap up, is, you know, you've heard what we're interested in, you've heard about the approach, and if what you're doing meets all of this, we are really, really interested, even if it's a cold email. It's best to come in through a warm introduction or catch us at a conference. So I think, you know, but we are really, really interested for things that meet the criteria. Quite often things are too late stage or much too early or, you know, remote geographically and not in our sector or what have you. But that's, but things that are in our focus area, we want to get that deal flow. And so I think what I'd, in closing, I'd suggest that anyone approaching us will get extra marks, extra attention, if they say, I listened to your podcast. And from that, I deduce that you, Amelia, are exactly the right person for my business. And this is what it is. And off we go. Right. So there you are.
You're getting all the emails.
or whoever, of course.
The gold star.
Absolutely. So I think on that last piece of advice, we'll close the session. So thank you very much, Pierre, Amelia.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you.